This is the Education Gadfly Show.
The worst typo in the world of education policy, we all know it. Instead of calling it public education, it's pubic education.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming our favorite co-host, a man who can spell America, Rick Hess.
Hey, how you doing, Mikey?
I guess Mitt Romney's campaign put out an app that misspelled America. Producer Joe, how'd they misspell that?
A-M-E-R-C-I-A.
They had a typo there.
You know, Amercia.
Typos have been in the news lately because I guess it turns out that the Florida Department of Education had a typo lately. Yeah, Amercia. Interesting.
Amercia.
The Florida Department of Education had a typo as well. And people made a lot of fun of that because they just recently, of course, came out with new standards for grading the writing test, which took spelling and grammar into account for the first time ever.
Booyah.
Yes. Yes, typos are tough. We were talking about this the other day. You know, the worst typo in the world of education policy, we all know it. Instead of calling it public education, it's pubic education. How many times have we seen that one? We hear that at a prominent university's graduation just a few weeks ago, that was on the cover of the program.
Really? Which university?
I believe it was the University of Texas. And they handed out these programs instead of scrapping them.
Wow.
That maybe was a bad, bad move.
That seems like an unfortunate development.
Okay. I wonder what Clarence Thomas would say about that. All right. It is now time for lots of things because we got a lot to cover. Pardon the gadfly. We got Amber's here with our research minute. Things are happening in the world of education policy, Rick. Let's talk about them.
You can't slow down, baby.
Ty, let's play. Pardon the gadfly.
Rick, you've written that the Department of Education's new Race to the Top competition for districts promises to be a mess. Why are you so pessimistic about the program?
I think all of the mistakes they made with a state-based Race to the Top, they have opted to repeat, except with even smaller chunks of money. But with the fact that now, you know, if you're a superintendent, A, winning District Race to the Top is a great resume builder, and B, it's going to be hard as a superintendent to explain to your school board and your community why you're not chasing these dollars. So you're going to have lots of districts across the country.
But what's wrong with it? What's wrong with it? They're saying what? You got to do innovative reforms?
Go ahead, baby.
Asking you. I haven't looked at it as closely. You've written about this. I really am curious.
We've written about this together, right? Well, one of the things we wrote about when the 19 priorities for State Race to the Top were first announced was the feds can make states do things. You can't make them do them well.
Right.
And to my mind, the stuff that worked in State Race to the Top was the stuff that was a question of, had you flipped the switch or not? Did you knock down data firewalls? Did you lift charter caps? It is all of the squirrely hundreds of pages of pablum about professional development that A, worries me, and that B, I think we've seen lots of violations of implementation. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at the 17 priorities of District Race to the Top, every single one of them is essentially a squirrely pablum exercise. It's about individualized learning environments. It's about what districts are doing to adopt, you know, cutting edge, world class practices and everything. There is almost nothing that's identifiable. And turns out that the union had us to sign off on every single district plan. Mm. Given that State Race to the Top was, to my mind, dulled by the fact that you had to try to get lots of districts to sign on, essentially 100% requirement that you have to have the union signing off on the doc, creates real limitations. And we're talking about $400 million for 15 to 20 districts.
Yeah.
Newark, Washington, D.C. are eligible for up to $25 million. That is 2 to 3% of 1 year's operational expenditures. It's not going to even come close to covering the implementation promised to hit the 17 priorities.
I mean, in truth, there are other competitive programs for districts that are almost of the same size in a variety of different areas. They are trying to get a lot of political hay from this because of the brand Race to the Top. Sounds like an election year Race to the Top, though, that they do not want to offend the unions, and so it's been watered down to be mostly meaningless. Waste of money. Okay, topic number two.
Yesterday, Fordham released a study arguing that the cost of implementing Common Core may vary significantly if states invest in online training and instructional tools and reappropriate some of what they're already spending on curriculum and instruction. Is expecting states to take advantage of these opportunities just wishful thinking?
Well, I don't think it's wishful thinking because they don't have money right now. Everybody's broke, yet most of the states have signed on to Common Core implementation. The biggest risk is that they will simply do nothing. They will spend no money. They will do nothing, really, to implement these standards. They may or may not take the new tests that come out in 2014, 2015, and their kids will do poorly on them.
So how much do you guys figure it'll cost?
So our estimates here is we had three different cost levels. So one is the business as usual. States go out, they buy a bunch of new textbooks, they do a lot of in-person training, they do regular paper and pencil tests. We think that could cost about $12 billion across the country, across these 45 states. On the other hand, if they do a bare bones approach where they basically do everything online, online textbooks, online PD, online assessments, it could be more like $3 billion. And a balanced is, you know, somewhere in the middle, say $7 or $8 billion. Now, the thing to know is that these states are already, their states and districts, spending money on textbooks and professional development and the like. So if you assume that they might repurpose some of that money, the costs come even less. And in fact, if you wanted to push the case, potentially they could save money by implementing the Common Core.
Now, what do you say to folks who say, for all the money we're spending right now, we can't even get teachers to do a particularly good job with the curriculum to which they have been exposed for years or decades?
You mean the standards to which they've been exposed?
That's right.
No, I think that's right. I mean, look, I think we have a couple of states where we've got examples of states that have driven the standards down into the classroom pretty effectively. Massachusetts is probably the best case. And so we want to look at those states, understand what they've done, and then also say, look, are there new opportunities because of technology? You don't have to literally go out and teach every teacher in person to these standards. Now, last summer, that's what Maryland did with a bunch of its Race to the Top money. And if you want to, you know, use a Race to the Top money for that, fine. But many states won't have that luxury. The question is, you know, have we gotten to the point where you can use online learning and online professional communities to do some of this stuff in a more affordable way? What we're trying to do in this paper is two things. One is to get people thinking differently about implementation and seeing that there are ways to do this in a cost-effective way. And number two, answer the question about whether or not the cost itself should be an argument against Common Core adoption. And our conclusion is no. I mean, it is going to cost money. The states do need to expect to spend extra money on implementation, but it doesn't need to be wildly expensive. Topic number three.
Mitt Romney's new education plan has garnered plenty of attention, but how much does it really differ from President Obama's policies?
So, Rick, we both wrote fairly generous, kind things about this plan last week. But others since then, like Jay Matthews, have said, look, these two presidential candidates, they basically agree on education. Mitt Romney is struggling to try to find some way to differentiate himself. Do you think that's fair, or do you see significant differences in these plans?
I mean, I think, one, it's hard to be particularly critical of any nominee at this stage in the process. I mean, right now Romney's laying out principles rather than programs. If you think back to Obama at this point, you know, or shortly after he got the nomination in 08, you know, candidates at this point simply don't say enough to really be too critical of what they're doing. No, I mean, Romney's absolutely drawn, at least in principle, some distinctions with Obama. He has suggested that the feds ought to dramatically dial back their involvement in accountability and in school improvement, which is very different from the ESEA blueprint. He, at least in his plan, he talked about making Washington vouchers a model for the nation, and he has talked about private school choice, which is very different from what the president's talking about. On higher education, President Obama has, you know, made a strong case that we have to pump more dollars into lending programs, particularly Stafford subsidies. Romney jumped on that bandwagon, but certainly his tune here was much more about the need to discipline costs. So, you know. What does any of that mean in practice? That's a whole other question.
I mean, to me, the most significant piece here is that he did come out and say, look, we should not be doing accountability from the federal level. It should be transparency. We've been promoting that here at Fordham for a long time, so I was happy to see that. It's also more in line with what Republicans on the Hill are saying. Certainly Lamar Alexander, John Klein would probably go even further. And that's putting Mitt Romney more in the center of gravity there among Republicans. That is an important distinction. The other thing is this talk about making Title I and special ed dollars portable. I think that's kind of an interesting idea, but I don't expect that to go anywhere. I think that that one gets jettisoned on the first day of office and just is something that kind of the campaign had to come out with to show something different.
I mean, the biggest thing is I feel, you know, like, you know, we were talking the other day about Gail Collins, New York Times columnist, had written some familiar New York Times cheap shot at a Republican kind of piece. And, you know, one of the things she attacked was that I guess Romney was I wasn't exactly sure what direction the attack is often when the New York Times discusses Republicans, but there's this notion that somehow it's a problematic that Romney has distanced himself from NCLB. On the other hand, if Romney had embraced NCLB like he did in 08, they'd be attacking him for that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of this stuff, I feel like, you know, President Obama has been aggressive about teacher quality, has been outspoken on charters. So, sure, there's absolutely some thematic differences there with reform-minded Republicans. The big difference is how much one thinks the stuff ought to be driven from Washington. Mm-hmm. And there, I think there's a substantial philosophical difference.
Do you think we're going to hear about education again before the election?
Not too much.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the safest bet, right? Romney felt he had to give this speech. He had to get some ideas out there in education. Maybe it helps him with Latinos, with women, but probably not going to be the centerpiece of his campaign.
Don't think so.
All right. That's all the time we had for Pardon the Gadfly. Don't worry, listeners. It's time for your favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the program.
Thank you much, Mike.
Did you have a nice Memorial Day weekend?
I did. I went to see DC United for the first time. You ever been to see a DC United game?
I have. It's been a while, but that's a lot of fun.
Ooh, screaming Eagles. The fans are crazy.
Yes, that's part
crazy.
Of the fun, right?
Yep. We were like three rows back from the fans, and goal time, everybody like throws their beer up in the air, and you get a beer shower. That was
nice.
The only part I didn't really like.
You know what I like about DC United is, and not to talk too much, pull this back into, you know, a discussion of larger societal issues, but it's a very diverse crowd.
Very diverse.
And I
crowd.
Love that, including the Screaming Eagles, right?
Yes.
You've got all the different immigrant groups in D.C. that come out, and, you know, plus white folks and
yeah.
Africans and
that's
everything. It's great. It's
where do they play?
At
RFK.
RFK.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. How many goals got scored?
Three, two. They won.
So you
eked
three,
it out.
Three beer shower things?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Huh.
It was fun.
Not
it was a good time.
All right. So what you got for us this week?
Oh, we got a new study out by Mike Podgorski and colleagues. Guess what it's about?
Pensions.
Pensions. All right. Good guess. He studies pension enhancements to the teacher pension system in Missouri, his home state. Missouri, like everybody else, had very flush times in the late 90s, so they chose to institute various sweeteners to their teacher pension systems as opposed to using the excess returns to offset periods of below average market performance.
Oops.
Which is what
shocker
be done. The sweeteners included changing the payout via the calculation of the teacher's final average salary, which originally was the highest 5 years of earnings. They changed that to the highest 3 years. They raised the cap twice on the cost of living adjustment, and they added a retroactive bonus for teachers who reached their 31st year of service, among other things. Analysts examined personnel data from 95 through 2009 from the Missouri Department of Ed. They looked at retirements documents, obviously, to determine the impact of these policies. They estimate that the net immediate increase in pension benefits for educators was roughly $1.6 billion, or $25,000 per teacher. Yet this does not take in consideration the promised benefits. That's just the immediate benefit. And it masked the distribution, which was very uneven. So in a nutshell, novice teachers and nearly new teachers can expect approximately $10,000 to $20,000 in an increase in pension wealth. The veteran teachers, you want to take a guess? $100,000 increase.
Cha-ching.
This is because, you know, the veterans are benefiting from more pension wealth than they actually put in, and the new teachers are paying for the sweeteners. Analysts conclude that DB plans, typically viewed as less risky for employees, potentially very risky if you're a young teacher, and the costs will continue to strain K-12 budgets.
So basically, we're saying that we gave all these goodies away to the older folks, and the younger folks are now paying for it.
That's it. And it's nice to have a study, though. We've kind of thought that, but, you know, they actually model it through various...
You know what they proved?
What did they prove?
That it is bad to be the last guy into a Ponzi scheme.
That's an excellent point.
That's true.
How do we undo these Ponzi schemes, though? I mean, I have yet to see anybody make a convincing argument for how this is actually going to go down, because some of these pension programs are protected by state constitutions. So what states do is they say, okay, we're going to just screw the young teachers by making them pay in a lot and reducing their benefits over time.
Well, you answered your own question.
That's it? That's all?
And you can raise taxes, and you can cut parks and roads and other services.
But there's no way to get out of the obligation. options to those teachers?
I don't think so.
Even if you declare bankruptcy in some way?
That's the open question.
That's an idea.
Yeah. Mm. If a district declared bankruptcy?
It's not, right. So it depends, I think, if it's a district, right? If it's a state system, it's not, you know, it's not clear what it would mean for a state to try to declare bankruptcy.
What if a state had every one of its schools become a charter school? Brand new charter schools that did not have these obligations to participate in the pension system.
But the liability would still exist, right? This is the problem that, right, this exists. You know, I mean,
teachers are going to be in an uproar.
I mean, Greece is a
and
really...
And I'm not saying we should. I mean, of course, these teachers deserve some pensions, but they might have to take a haircut like everybody else. I mean, we might not be able
Greece
to,
is a really
have to
nice
unsweeten their sweeteners.
Model of how these things play out, right? This is what happens with Ponzi schemes eventually.
Yeah. But, I mean, in Missouri, this was fascinating to me. So from 2005, every year for the next 8 years, they raised the contribution rate by a full 1%. I mean, every year. So, I mean, that's what Mike was saying in the paper.
And is that just for the young teachers?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, they had to raise it, but I mean, across the board. But still,
but then they probably grandfathered it, right? Or did they?
See, they usually do. They often grandfather these
maybe.
Things.
So
maybe they
didn't
did.
So right.
That.
So it's just new. So that's, you know, that's an 8% pay decrease essentially
No, I mean that's the thing. I mean we've got half all these people out there right now. Matt Miller today in the Post. Other people saying we should be more like Finland, these other countries, and recruit from the top third of colleges and have very selective admissions. There's a lot of that I really like. I like that. I mean I see the line of thinking there, but then we're actually decreasing starting teachers' pay. You know, we got to connect the dots here, people. Drives me crazy. All right. Well, Rick, so it's just hopeless. We're just going to have to.
I don't
to
know. I think that's an incisive idea that we should try to hire good teachers. And thank God that, you know, folks are out there with such kind of powerful concepts.
Well, some have gone further and started talking about how you might actually do it. I mean, you'd have to put a lot of ed schools out of business. You'd have to raise standards for people coming in. And you got to raise salaries. And the hard thing is we can't raise salaries at the same time we're paying off all these pensions we can't afford.
Use digital learning to extend their reach, as Brian Hassel says. You know?
I guess so. I guess so.
That excited about that?
I'm, as a Waldorf parent, I'm just not so sure about all that.
Oof.
All right. And, you know, not to mention the new news this week that we now have a new digital divide that the low-income kids are getting on computers and they're using it to waste time.
There's
a shocker.
Yes. And it's the highly educated parents who are the ones who are keeping their kids off of computers and TVs because, well, lo and behold, too much TVs and computers, not good for kids.
It's not as if adults don't waste a ton of time on Facebook, though. I mean, let's be honest. So.
Are you speaking about yourself?
Anyway, no, of course not me. Mm-mm.
All right. Okay, guys. Well, that is all the time. It's been fun. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.